Welcome to the Sandwich Parenting Podcast. I am your host, Sherry Yuen Hunter. Here, we speak with amazing guests to make the world a better place by helping people heal from intergenerational trauma. Sandwich parents are in between the way we got parented and the way we now want to parent our children.
Atra Tarfa is a survivor of child sexual abuse, narcissistic abuse, domestic violence, miscarriage, high conflict divorce, co-parenting with a narcissist, and non-parent expected. She believes in fierce self-compassion and has dedicated her life to the healing of trauma. Now, this is actually a very poignant interview for me to do because Atra is a classmate of mine from the initial course at the International Association of Trauma Recovery Coaching and is someone who both intimidated me and inspired me on my healing journey. And she's laughing as I'm saying this. She's also a certified trauma recovery coach through the association, but is now one of the most amazing supervisors there. She teaches, she mentors, and all of that. She's also on the board of PATH, which is an amazing organization that helps heal addictions and underlying traumas. So everyone, please welcome me in celebrating Atra.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, this is really special to be having like this different relationship with you because we've kind of had different types of relationships through the time that we've been together. And I really love this opportunity to see you through the eyes of someone who's interviewing you, you know, for something very specific, which is a podcast that is for parents who are breaking intergenerational trauma, for parents who are struggling. So thank you for your time.
I'm excited to be here. Like super excited. I'm just kind of letting it all land because we've talked about doing this for 2 years. You know, it's just interesting how it's taken 2 years to get here, though I talk to you on a weekly basis.
So, isn't that funny? Yeah.
Yeah. Things happen when they happen. You know?
I love that. Things happen when they happen. When it's right, it's right. And when we're not ready, we're not ready. And it's all good. So to start us off, and I know some of the story, but I'm really, you know, in awe of how you got to where you are now. So can you tell us, what is your origin story? Why does Atra do what Atra does? And how did you get here?
So I was thinking about this question because you had told me that, you know, it's sort of like a base question that you ask all of your guests. And I found myself getting curious about how many answer in the way in which I'm going to answer, which is, I feel my story starts before I was even born.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, my story is I am the daughter of an immigrant from Thailand post-war. My biological parents met in Thailand right at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a lot going on. My mother is the eldest of the eldest daughter. So she is the eldest daughter of the eldest daughter. And in my very matriarchal family, that's a lot of responsibility for the eldest daughter. And my grandmother didn't want that responsibility. So my mom spent a lot of her time being passed from home to home, left in lots of vulnerable spaces until she met a soldier. And I know she was exposed to lots of mistreatment of women because she was in a southern region of Thailand where a lot of soldiers hung out at that time. Even to this day, some of the soldiers hang out, sort of like a red light district type of thing. Anyways, she was working down in that area, I guess as a cocktails drink girl or something, and had met I've known as my father, who I still call my dad to this day. So she was there until she met him and then he left. And there back then there wasn't email or very much. We didn't have instantaneous access to each other. So he left her and because he had to return to the United States. And with the intention of, I'll bring you over. Now, I have an older brother who's full Thai. I am half Thai. And months pass and she doesn't really hear very much. You know, it takes long time for letters to travel back and forth. Mm. And so my mother met someone else during this time. And that is who my biological father is. And he was young. She was 20. He was 19. The war, again, was sort of wrapping up. And he wasn't ready to commit to my mother. And so she gets word from my father that he is ready to commit and he's got all the paperwork ready for my brother and her to come over. And so, do you want to come to America? And so here you have my mom who, let me make a choice between a man who doesn't want to be with me living in a district I don't want to live where I'm raising a kid and in poverty, to having a shot at going to America. So he, my biological father, drove my mother to the airport. And when she landed in America, she married my dad. Not knowing any English, she just was told to nod. And, in our work now, we talk a lot about voice and choice, and kind of hard to have voice and choice when you don't even know that that's an option. So she married him. He was very abusive, verbally, physically, shamed her a lot. They were only married for 4 years. And I was conceived in Thailand, but I was born, I believe it was 6 or 7 months later after she landed in America. They had gotten married in New Mexico and then we had moved to Virginia. And I was born in Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. The story is that when I was born, my dad was like, she's not mine. And my mother was like, we'll make it work. We'll make it happen. So he put his last name on my birth certificate and they kept that secret from me for 22 years. Mm. So I didn't know. And apparently I have a half sister and I have a half brother. And yeah, so that's a whole story within itself. So I feel like my origin story begins in trauma. Yeah. And so they were married for about 4 years. He was quite abusive. She married another person 6 months later after they were divorced. The divorce was pretty nasty. And to sort of get back at my mother, my dad took custody of us because my mother was, he was the in the power over position, right? He was a white male who had, was in the military, and she was an immigrant woman with no education who came over here for a better life. And all she cared about were her children. Mm. So he took the one thing that she cared about away from her because he could. Then he realized he couldn't handle it. And thank God, he said, "Hey, I can't do this. You take the kids. You're married now and you take them." And so it wasn't an easy life being raised by my mom with my stepfather, but I got a feeling it was a better one than being raised by my dad in the state that he was in back then. So yeah, so then, I spent my time growing up as a kid as a military dependent. People call them military brats. I wouldn't say I was a brat.
I wouldn't call you a brat.
Thanks. And home was not safe. We were stepchildren and we were treated as such. At least I was. My brother, being the oldest and a boy, but particularly in Asian culture, is always favored. So, And my brother didn't have a father. My brother's father wasn't in the picture, whereas mine was. And even though he was a phone call a week or a child support check a month, he still had a presence. And I think my stepfather resented that a bit and took that out on me often. And he was very physically abusive to me. And I grew up in a home where, physical violence was common. They would pit my brother and I against each other when we got in trouble. Like, hey, go get the stick, or hey, do this, or, sort of enabling us or each other to be part of the pain inflicted on the other child. And if you didn't, you were punished for that. I remember that. I remember lots of times standing in the kitchen with our pants dropped and being beaten. Like, I remember walking to school with, you know, I don't know, in every Asian home, there typically is a big old wooden spoon and fork and on the wall. And that wooden spoon would be used a lot to, you know, smack me on my legs. Or I remember walking to school, elementary school, feeling so embarrassed because I had still red welts on my leg from, you know, the whatever trouble I had gotten into before. And my stepfather, he would say things like, you know, you must like getting hit because you're always getting hit. So you start to believe that you are responsible for whatever it is, right? Your own pain, your own shame, your own, all the things. Like, it's your fault and you're to blame.
You mean even the beating, really? What they're saying is you're the one causing me to beat you.
Yeah. You must like it. It's your fault you're getting beat. You must like it because it happens so often.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the message.
Yeah. So I grew up thinking, you know, that it was me and really not liking men or father figures at all.
Can't imagine that you would. No.
At all. And then he ended up cheating on my mother, came back. I've always had visions and dreams ever since I was young. And so I remember before he came home from Westpac, which is like a time where they go away for 6 months and come back if you're active CDD in the military here in America. And he came back and he had told, right before he had come back, I had a dream and it was very dark. And there was a ring and there were two hands and it was like a solid gold ring, like a band, and two hands grabbing each side, and it pulled the ring apart, and it was like a slow motion shatter of the ring. And the very next day, he tells my mother that he wants a divorce because he's falling in love with someone who he's still married to this day in Pensacola, Florida. And we had orders to move to Hawaii. And at this time, I'm about 14, and we had orders to move to Hawaii. And so it's like, hey, I'm back. I want to break up our family. And oh, by the way, you're forced to move out of your military housing and the military is transferring us to Hawaii. So you got to go. So we moved to Hawaii knowing that our family was breaking apart. My brother chose to stay back. He didn't help us at all. No. And so I sort of became the man of the house. No. And
you had to, you had to, like, you were forced to take on some responsibility. Otherwise, how were things going to happen?
So I had to. We had my sister, she was born when I was about 10. So I had a little sister to help my mom take care of. And it was the three of us for quite some time, for a few years. The divorce took a while. There was a time, it was really hard on my mother. It was really hard on me. I think I had, you know, during the time when I was younger, they had left me in such vulnerable spaces so often. I was, you know, sexually abused by the same man for a good while. Mm. And I remember before we had moved earlier on, when she was still married to my ex-stepfather, I remember telling them, like, I remember seeing there was a old commercial of Emmanuel Lewis, and he's, if anybody is listening, he was an actor on the show called Webster back in the 80s. Mm. And he was going through these big, big words. And if anybody's familiar with the Bobby Brown video, every little step you take, it's like words that size. And they're different colors. And it says, stop, go tell. And he's running through them. And he's talking about child sexual abuse. Mm. And if this happens, and like, you stop, you go and you tell. And although we had moved away from this person that had sexually abused me, I still, at I think 9 years old, felt the need to tell my family. And they were laying down on the couch watching TV. And I'll never forget it. They were just in their sort of own world. And my mother was laying on my stepfather. And I went and I said, hey, I said, this happened to me. Remember so-and-so, this happened to me. And they, without missing a beat, my stepfather looked at me and he said, well, we're not there, so we can't do anything about it now. And that's in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think in that moment, that taught me to just stuff away any pain. Like, instantly. I learned, stuff it away, right? So when, by the time we had gotten to Hawaii and, you know, my family was getting divorced and my mom was in so much pain, I had just stuffed mine away. Yeah. I mean, I would wake up and she would be crying downstairs at night, and she barely survived that divorce because she really loved my stepfather. Mm-hmm. And she barely survived it. And when she started sort of coming out of it, her girlfriends would help her and she would start to go on dates, and she believed them when they told her, nobody's going to want you if they know you have older children. So she's in her 30s, mid 30s, and I'm a teen, and she tells everybody that I'm the babysitter. So I wasn't able to exist during that time. I was the babysitter that would show up and take care of my little sister. Talk about neglect. It was a long time of my life where I was the babysitter. Maybe I still have a babysitter part in me. I haven't really thought about that until this moment. But and then I somehow managed to survive high school, back and forth between living with her and as a single mother. And then my father that she was married to, again, remember, this whole time he's been a check or a phone call, still active in the military. He lived overseas a lot. And when it got real rough between my mom and I, so I couldn't understand why she kept going from guy to guy. It just didn't make sense to me. So my dad was like, you can come stay with me. So I leave Hawaii and I moved to Western Pennsylvania, which, you know, was a shocker because I didn't understand. I didn't even know what racism was until I moved there. Growing up in the military base, everybody's mixed. If you were one race, that was pretty rare. So I didn't know even the term or what the feeling of racism felt like until my teens. And then after I felt it, when I went back to Hawaii, I was able to identify when it happened to my mom. And I hadn't realized it had been happening to my mom all my life. I just didn't know what that was. And how we were treated often by people who feel that American citizens that are naturalized, which I think everyone is, because no one's really from this country unless you're indigenous. They would often treat her, you know, my mother be told to go back to her home country growing up. But yeah, so that's a lot of it. There's a lot left out, but I had some really wonderful parts of my childhood. Lots of things that I learned, and lots of my stepfather was awful to me, but he's the reason why I like fishing and I find fishing calming. Like just things like that. I love, his parents were from Montana, so that has a very special place in my heart. I used to spend my summers in Montana as a child. But yeah, I ended up going back and forth between my mom and there, and then my stepfather, or I lived with my father for a little bit till he kicked me out because he never knew how to deal with the teen, and he was really pretty abusive still. And somehow I managed to graduate high school and get into college and be the first of my family to even go to school, to get a higher education. And yeah, so that's sort of the beginning of my adulthood life. So that's,
well, then, you know, knowing all that about you and thinking about what you had to overcome, you know, what brought you to now being a healer, now being, you know, why is Achara now a trauma recovery coach? Why is Achara so adamant and protective of her clients? Why is Achara such a big part of PATH? You know, what makes you, because going through adversity can either break us, you know, or really be the starting point for, and this is how I want to live my life. So how did you go from that beginning of your adulthood? Well, why don't we start with what is it that you do now? And then, you know, kind of bridge that.
Sure. So now the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, I am an advocate of self-agency, of people having their voice and choice with respect to differences. People think that agreement and connectedness are the same thing, and they're not.
That's a big one that I had to learn, you know? So yes, I hear you. Yeah. And conversely, what you're saying is having a disagreement or having a riff doesn't automatically mean no connectedness. So, right. So like you're saying, like we're pulling those two concepts apart.
Right. Right. I mean, it's about relationships, right? Complex trauma is a trauma of disruption in relationship, right? Chronic abuse and stress over time, developmental years, which affect relationship and adult years. So when it comes to relationship, I think of my marriage, I think of, you know, you, I think of my best friends, you know, which you are one of, like, I think, you know, we don't always agree, but there's still such connectedness, right? And so, yeah, I spend a lot of my time now advocating for self-agency with the understanding that you can still have connectedness without agreement.
And you do that in different ways. So you are a coach, you are an instructor, you are a supervisor, you are a board member. Tell us a little bit about all these things and why that theme of supporting people to agency is occurring in all of these things that you do now.
So in PATH, which is a lovely organization, it is IFS and Mindful Self-Compassion Informed, and it's an online support group that meets several times a week, different for different reasons. We have all parts meeting, which, you know, in IFS terms, is we understand that we have some ego, some sub-personalities or other, like many selves, we're made up of many parts. And at these meetings, there's a reading, people come together, there's a reading, there's a reflection, there's questions, and whatever parts sort of show up for you upon the reflection time, people are not interrupted, there's no feedback given. It's based on 8 insights, the very first one being I am self, the central core of compassionate wisdom, right? And so the goal of internal family systems is to, one of them is to lead a self-led life and to bring all of your parts into harmony. And, you know, even internally, you know, all of our parts don't get along, right? But they can still be connected, right?
It's so funny. As you're saying all this, I'm like, yeah, I've got lots of parts that don't really get along.
Yeah. Well, some of them are pretty opposite of each other and they do not agree. Like you'll have a part that's like, I want to do this. And there'll other parts like, I don't want to do that. You know what happens? But how can we foster harmony and connectedness with parts of us that are in opposite sides, you know, or disagree? And the same thing, so I work towards helping people understand that internally and then understanding that that can happen externally too. And we're still okay. So PATH gives us a space to sort of just speak for our parts, not from our parts. I help in that organization at this point now as it's growing and it's growing, which is really cool. I help to onboard facilitators along with the founder and really just sort of bring an awareness that PATH even exists because a lot of people can't afford internal family systems or mindful self-compassion or any type of coaching or therapy at all. And though we are made up of therapists and coaches as facilitators, we are not therapy, right? And we are not coaching sessions. We're just an online support group where people, we try to do our best to curate and foster connectedness and safety. Lots of people never experienced anything like that.
No. And that's why I want to take out the just, right? Because in healing, healing, there's so many different modalities and different people need different things at different times during their healing journey. And, you know, I never want to say just because there are so many people that would benefit from joining a group, where no, it's not therapy, no, it's not coaching, but there is that deliberate facilitation of psychological safety to be able to allow yourself to have headspace to even think about your parts. So I would say not just, and really highly just kind of like insert myself here for a bit to say like this. This really is something that it's quite powerful. It's quite powerful as a healing modality. And I hope that everyone has a chance to think about PATH and what it offers. Because I told you this before we started recording, but I've been referring clients, you know, to say like maybe in between coaching or, you know, if you can't afford to pay for a course, start somewhere, start in a place where you can start to experience that fierce self-compassion and use a modality that is quickly gaining, you know, recognition throughout the world as here's a way to think about this. Here's a way to see and make sense of what's happening inside your messy brain, because, you know, it's hard, right? When everybody, when all your parts are clamoring and all your parts are yelling at each other, like how can you figure out what's going on?
You know, you got to slow down, speed up sort of way. And some of our meetings are for women. You know, we launched an LGBTQIA meeting yesterday, Friday, the very first one.
Yeah.
We have people of the global majority meeting. So
that's right.
Yeah. As you know, people of color, also, you know, known as BIPOC, we have that. We have a men's meeting.
Mm.
And then we have our general, we have three general meetings called All Parts that, you know, anybody is welcome with all of their parts. And I think we do a really great job of providing an environment where you and your parts are witnessed.
Mm.
Are witnessed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are witnessed, whether, you know, you have grieving parts and according to, you know, David Kessler, grief needs to be witnessed. And I think I forget who it was, I'll have to look it up, but you know, healing comes when we are able to express our pain, our suffering, our thoughts, our emotions in the presence of an empathetic witness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone who's holding compassionate space with us. And honestly, you know, many people are well-intentioned, right? But it ends up being more like toxic positivity, like, oh, well, think of, you know, well, it's not that bad, or hey, buckle up, buttercup, or instead of just holding space, I've gotten used to the habit of when someone calls me now, or even with clients, you know, it's okay, what would you like? Would you like me just to hold space and listen? Or would you like me to offer my thoughts into this conversation when you're done? I just want you to hold space. Or, yeah, I'd like to know what you think. And just asking is so validating and so important. And I think that so many of us, especially of us that are healers, have such caregiving parts that we forget that showing up and just listening is really a lot.
And I like that you're using a consent-based format in interacting with a client, because for a client, you're reminding them that they have voice and they have choice and that what they feel matters, right? Like you're just sort of constantly role modeling that. You're constantly saying, this is what it feels like. Like, you know, like let's experience this together. And when you start getting used to the idea of, well, Atra always asks and checks in with how I'm feeling. And now I'm realizing, no, I don't want advice. Like right this moment, what I need isn't advice. What I need right this moment is someone just to witness and help me be aware of what is going on, because I'm actually capable of processing and getting to my results. I just want to talk about it first, right? Like it's because so many of us, like you said, being well-intentioned, we jump in to help, like, here, you know what, my sister used this medication, and you know, my doctor recommended this, and you know, my colleague, you know, like here, and that may not be what they need at the moment. So I think it's beautiful to introduce that.
And I think as that happens, you know, there, people do have a tendency to ruminate at times and need to be witnessed several times and by several people. And I think there's a tendency in our industry to
bypass that.
Be sensitive about it because we're, you know, feeling like we're not. That's why I love that in internal family systems, we're often, you know, trained to check in with ourselves and and what's happening in ourselves as the practitioner. So yeah, maybe there's a part of that person that feels like it needs to sort of ruminate for a while. And really, how is that landing with me as a practitioner? And moving beyond, you know, the speed of trust doesn't ever work in our favor. So just, you know, checking in with me and what's coming up for me is how I best serve my clients, honestly, and being able to hold space compassionately for them as I point out, you know, zoomed out perspectives and connecting dots for them that they necessarily don't see. And then in the association, I get to teach on how to do that, which is really freaking amazing and a bit mind-blowing and surreal. Mm-hmm. I think I've described it to a fellow supervisor as like, I feel like I've been like given like an all-access pass, and I'm still sort of like, I'm in, but I'm kind of like, okay, now like, is there an expiration date on this? Or is there, you know, like, let me go, you know, go to the punch bowl and maybe I'll have a drink real quick, or like, it just still feels very surreal. And there's so much more that's on the horizon to explore about myself and how I can contribute to the organization as a whole and the fellow colleagues that we have and mm-hmm. the upcoming students. And still, I think when we first met 2 years ago, I would say to you and Sale, another friend of ours, you know, like, well, I'm just me. There's nothing special about me. I never forget, like, Sale would just be like, what? And so now it's being able to step into spaces and have my own, you know, self agency and for advocacy and being like, you know what, I am special. I worked hard and I've done some serious dive into myself and work. And that is something to offer and of value to others who are on the same path.
I love that for you so much, because when we met, and I'm going to say this is what, 2 years ago, it was because we were both taking the course to become trauma recovery coaches, although many of us were taking the course for the content, not necessarily to become a coach. But for you, I remember, you know, so this is the International Association for Trauma Recovery Coaching. And I remember, you know, us doing the course and that you started asking, like, okay, so are you all on the pathway, you know, to do the advanced course and then to do the supervisor course? And I remember thinking, like, you're pretty awesome. I think you're going to go do that, but I'm not sure, you know, that I am. But you did inspire me to continue with the advanced coaching course. So we did, you know, get to do that course. And then you went on to become a supervisor, to take everything that we learned. You're shaping the organization. You're working closely with the executive director and founder, Bobby, whom I also interviewed, by the way. She's also a guest. but that you went ahead and said, initially, I don't think I'm special. And now you're able to say, I'm bringing the whole of me into every class, into every coaching session, into every supervision session, into every conversation that you have with Bobby and the other leaders of the organization. Like, I can see you bringing yourself. I can see the value of what you bring to the organization. So it's really fun to watch from, you know, this other side and observe you doing precisely what you're like, well, I don't know if I can do it. And like, yeah, but girl, you are.
You are doing this. You're doing it. You're doing the damn thing.
You are doing the damn thing. And so we kind of touched on IFS, and I'm pretty sure by now most people who have been, you know, learning a little bit more about their own traumas and looking at the different modalities and looking at all the different options, I'm sure they've heard of IFS. But if you were to explain this to someone who is, you know, kind of thinking about doing their healing, like they're just trying to start their journey, right? How would you explain IFS, internal family systems, to them? And why, you know, why do you see this as a really great way to manage your healing process?
Great question. So as I said, growing up, relationship gets disrupted, concept of it, mm-hmm. It completely gets distorted. Mm-hmm. And I landed in an abusive marriage that almost cost me my life. Mm-hmm. And didn't tell a lot of people that I was being abused. And it started out, you know, I was groomed. And when I say groomed, like, you know, the love bombing, the dating, the, all the things. Then the isolation from my family began because, you know, I'm the only one who cares about you. Look at how they treat you. And so you start to believe that. And I end up marrying this person and surviving this abusive marriage. But I kept it all a secret for a really, really long time because of shame. And so, and also when I'm a believer, right? So I'm a faith-based person. I have a relationship with Jesus. And I was raised as a Buddhist and then converted in my 20s. And that caused me to be disowned from my mom, who didn't understand it, who is a believer now, by the way. But she like didn't like, you know, my ex didn't like her. He didn't like, she didn't like him. Like it was just sort of a whole thing. Anyways, so I got isolated and then the church, you know, would say I would, most people when they're faith-based, they turn to their church first for healing. And I went there and for several years endured more abuse because the church is not trauma-informed. And I have no problem saying that right now. I mean, I've encountered some people in the church who are trauma-informed, but the church as a whole is not trauma-informed. And there's a lot of spiritual gaslighting that occurs. And for a woman who is being battered and abused, they're not equipped to handle that. And it would be more of like victim blaming and shaming. So because of that, I kept what was happening to me quite secret for a very, very long time. I was abused all through my pregnancy physically. And even then, like being asked if I'm okay in front of my abuser by my medical team or things of that nature, right? So that brings me to internal family systems. If I had understood that all of the parts inside of me back then, the ones that wanted to tell, the ones that were wanting to keep it secret because I was ashamed, if I had understood back then that all of those parts were all just trying to keep me safe in their own way and to learn to accept all of them, show love to all of them, and that there wasn't just one right way, one wrong way. As trauma survivors, we have very black, white thinking. Oftentimes church is very black, white, heaven, hell.
All or nothing.
All or
nothing. If you have one speck of sin, that kind of like,
completely ruined
the whole.
I mean, I even married my ex-husband because I had slept with him out of wedlock and I thought, and I believed him when it was like, oh, well, you're supposed to be, I'm supposed to be your husband and you're supposed to be my wife. And if I didn't, how was I going to go to my next partner and say, I had already given my body to somebody else? Like, it's just all these very religious, not Jesus-based, religious man-based sort of spiritual gaslighting that occurred. So if I had somebody back then who had known about internal family systems, because internal family systems is an evidence-based modality that incorporates a higher power. Mm-hmm. And that's what drew me to internal family systems, because I can incorporate my faith as where I get my capital S-E-L-F energy. Like I receive my self energy from my relationship with Jesus. And that is what overflows out of me and how I can lead the other selves in me, right? The other parts of me. So that's sort of how that makes sense to me and why I do what I do and why I use the modality and mindful self-compassion on top of that, because, you know, God is love, Jesus is love, and mindful self-compassion is a counter-shaming modality that is based on stress responses, or people call them trauma responses, right? Like the fight, flight, freeze. I've also added fawn into that. A lot of people don't understand fawn, but those of us that are domestic abuser or survivors, or those of us that are raised in cultures where shame is used as a motivator, understand fawn. Mm. And so I use that modality as well, because it all intertwines for me. It all intertwines. And then I also use a lot of Deb Dana's work and polyvagal theory based off of Steve Porges' work. So those three combined are what influence what I do and how I do what I do.
Well, thank you for doing what you do. And I now that brings me to my last question for you, you know, which is, given the work that you do, what is your one piece of advice that you would give to a parent? And I know you're a parent, you have children, who is trying to break intergenerational trauma and parent their children differently.
My one advice, I think, is two words. So in internal family systems, I mentioned, you know, capital S-E-L-F, right? The higher power portion. But then there's the capital S, lowercase E-L-F. And I'm just kind of getting into terms here, but they're really the concepts are that my capital S, lowercase E-L-F, that is made up of characteristics of like compassion and courage and clarity. And they're called the eight C's. Anyone can look them up, right? But I like to add what's important as a parent and as a trauma survivor. I like to add the word, the C word of choice, right? And I've seen other people who are in internal family systems use that as well. And I think as a parent and as a someone who has survived trauma or childhood emotional neglect over time, choice is important. We often think that we don't have a choice. We're not often given choice. Choice is often taken away from us. And so just a reminder that I, as a parent, have choice, even though maybe I wasn't raised with it. As a parent, as an adult, I get to have that. And I get to teach that and model that to my kids, voice and choice. So choice is super important. And then also we have something called the five P's, like playfulness is one of them, patience. And for the P, I like to add the word permission. Like, having flexibility and being okay with things not necessarily not working out the way, like, for instance, you know, we live 30 minutes away from my daughter's school. She's in a Montessori school, and there will be times where she's late, right? And I'm doing stuff, or maybe my husband isn't able to help or whatever. And I used to get so upset about when my kids were late for school. Like, I had to sit and talk with my parts about what is going on. Why is it such, what is, and just really slowing down the shame response of what I was feeling, the stress response of what I was feeling. Because at the end of the day, if my child is 3 minutes late to school, you know, would I rather, what is she going to remember? That we sang songs on the way, like Katy Perry, Roar, who she calls Kitty Cat. She loves singing Roar on the way to school. And so we'll sing Roar, right? And it's changed the way I parent when I give myself permission and she gets permission and my kids get permission. And that also has a lot to do with when we grow up in homes in which I described that fawn response, that trauma fawn response, because it's this fear, right? That something is going to happen if we don't mitigate everything around us. Yeah. And so that turned inward is rigidity. We try to control everything. Everything, I feel like I have my fist to my chest right now because it feels like everything has to be done a particular way and on lock, right? Just to be safe. Yeah. And we don't understand that the counter shame to that is of self-compassion is flexibility, is permission, right? So yeah, I would offer the words choice and permission to parents, just to remember that it's okay.
Well, Ms. Atra, thank you so much for your amazing time, your insights, your passion for this work. Thank you for sharing. And I know that we're going to continue this conversation outside of this podcast. And I will make sure that I include all your websites so that people can find you and talk with you. We will include the links to PATH so that those people who would like to do the work can start somewhere. And find like-minded people. So thank you for what you do. And thanks, I will chat with you again.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciated that. I think we opened with the concept of, you know, agreement doesn't necessarily equal connectedness. And I think as parents, we learn that too, right? We, our kids and I disagree often, but we can still remain connected as a family. How can I foster that through that? And I just love talking about parenting things with you and concepts like that with you, because you're so fun. I often think, you know, as a believer, there's this cliche of what would Jesus do, right, in situations. But when it comes to parenting, often sometimes I hear you and my voice in my head, like, what would Sherry do? It's really funny.
You mean what would Sherry advise you to do? Not necessarily what would Sherry do.
Yes, that is true too.
Because we are human, and and I can tell you what I would do if I were calm, and then I could, you know,
keeping it real.
Keeping it real. Thank you for that. I have times when I channel my inner Achara too. So, you know. All right, my friend, listen, I know you're running, because I know you have lots going on this weekend. And I am grateful, as usual, for your time.
Thanks. And thanks to your listeners, anyone who listens to this, thanks for having me. 2 years in the making.
2 years in the making.
Thank you so much for listening to the Sandwich Parenting Podcast. I hope, like me, you've learned something new that will help you along with your parenting journey. If you wish, you can always connect with me at www.sandwichparenting.com.